Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, May 5th, 2022. Ukraine's military says it is making gains against Russian forces in eastern Ukraine ahead of Monday's holiday in Russia, Victory Day, marking the Soviet Union's defeat of Nazi Germany during World War II. We'll hear from Ukraine's ambassador to the United States about what Russian President Vladimir Putin may say or do on Monday and how Ukraine might respond. The Pentagon denying it is sharing intelligence with Ukraine to target Russian generals. Also today, a bill to help the U.S. compete economically against China moves ahead in the U.S. Senate. We'll talk to a Reuters reporter about the next move, reaching a compromise with the U.S. House to get a final bill that can pass both chambers and be signed into law. The U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer scheduling a vote for next Wednesday related to a bill that would codify the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision that made abortion a constitutional right. And Hillary Clinton weighing in on this week's leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that, if it's final, would overturn Roe. President Biden names a new press secretary, promoting his deputy press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre. She'll become the first black woman to be in that job. And a Cinco de Mayo celebration at the White House, the president and first lady joined by the first lady of Mexico. From Associated Press, Ukraine's military said Thursday that it recaptured some areas in the south and repelled Russian attacks in the east as a bloody battle raged at a steel mill in Mariupol, where Ukrainian troops are holed up in tunnels and bunkers, fending off a Russian onslaught. 10 weeks into a devastating war, Ukrainian and Russian forces are fighting village by village as Moscow struggles to gain momentum in the eastern industrial heartland of the Donbas. That reporting from AP. Ukraine's ambassador to the United States, Oksana Makarova, sitting down with reporters in Washington, D.C., a program hosted by the Christian Science Monitor. And the first question from the Monitor's Washington Bureau Chief, Linda Feldman.
I think a lot of us are looking ahead to May 9th, the Russian Victory Day holiday, and the reported plans by President Putin to declare that Donetsk, Luhansk, the city of Kherson are now Russian territories. What will Ukraine's response be?
Well, there is a couple of questions in this one question, actually. Yeah. One is, you know, the remembrance of the end of the Second World War. And Russians hadn't been really effective, or they thought so in the past, in rewriting the history and lying about so many events. But we, people who believe in truth and who believe in access to information, remember very well that the war, World War II, like Ukrainian war right now, did not start 71 days ago. The World War II also did not start in 1941, like Russians are trying and were trying to show it during the Soviet times. It started in 1939, and it started by two countries, by Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. We Ukrainians, with the whole world, will mourn on 8th of May, and we will remember everyone who's fallen on the May 8th and 9th. And I think, you know, it's very cynical of Russian Federation to, right now, when they, A, brutally attacked sovereign state, when they started a war in the middle of Europe, when they do exactly what Nazis did, you know, with all the symbols, with genocide, with killing Ukrainians only because we're Ukrainians, with, you know, ridiculous manifestations of anti-Semitism just recently by Minister Lavrov, you know, trying to attack the very notion of the Holocaust and essentially trying to spread lies that it's almost Jewish people who killed Jewish people, with them targeting Baban Yar, with them targeting churches in Ukraine, targeting mosques. So I think, you know, what they have to do is actually go ahead, A, stop this aggression, be withdraw from our territory and repent their sins rather than try to use and misuse the notion of a great anniversary of the end of the Nazi war and liberation of Europe and liberation of Ukraine for their own purposes. So whatever they plan for the May 9th, whether it's going to be some kind of parade in Moscow or what we heard, some kind of parades in some of the occupied areas, you know, whatever they do in Ukraine is just war crimes, aggression, and they have no right to declare anything a Russian territory. Ukraine is peaceful, sovereign country. We will, some parts of Ukraine, you know, unfortunately and tragically are illegally occupied right now by the Russian force. But even in Kherson, you know, which has been under occupation for a long time, on a daily basis we see ordinary Ukrainians, armless, going to the main square and saying, it's Ukraine, go out from our city. Even in Mariupol, which is 95% destroyed, which has been, you know, erased, some parts of it, from the earth, even there on Azovstal, our brave defenders, the two regiments that are there, are holding in, been fully encircled with civilians that are there, with Russia is not allowed to get out through the humanitarian corridors, promising that for many weeks now. So even there, Ukrainian flag still stands.
Oksana Makarova is Ukraine's ambassador to the United States, sitting down with reporters, a roundtable news conference put together by the Christian Science Monitor. This from Haaretz. In a call with Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, Russian President Vladimir Putin apologized for Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's assertion that Adolf Hitler had Jewish origins. Bennett accepted Putin's apology for Lavrov's remarks and thanked him for clarifying the Russian president's attitude toward the Jewish people and the memory of the Holocaust, Bennett's office said in a statement. The two leaders also stressed the importance of May 9th, the day of victory of Nazi Germany, to Israelis and Russians, as well as the memory of victims of war and the Holocaust, that reporting from Haaretz. At the Pentagon, Press Secretary John Kirby addressing a story in the New York Times. That story reads, the United States has provided intelligence about Russian units that has allowed Ukrainians to target and kill many of the Russian generals who have died in action in the Ukraine war, according to senior American officials. Ukrainian officials said they had killed approximately 12 generals on the front lines, a number that has astonished military analysts. That was in the New York Times. Here is the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby today.
Just to address an issue which I know is on everyone's mind today, and this is the issue of intelligence sharing with Ukraine. I just want to stress a couple of things. First, the United States provides battlefield intelligence to help Ukrainians defend their country. We've talked about that quite a bit. We do not provide intelligence on the location of senior military leaders on the battlefield or participate in the targeting decisions of the Ukrainian military. The Ukrainians have, quite frankly, a lot more information than we do. This is their country, their territory, and they have capable intelligence collection abilities of their own. Ukraine combines information that we and other partners provide with the intelligence that they themselves are gathering on the battlefield. And then they make their own decisions, and they take their own actions. And I think it's important not to forget that this is a war the Russians started, and of course they can end it tomorrow.
The Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby in the Pentagon briefing room. Bipartisan Ukraine aid talks among the leaders of the U.S. House and Senate Appropriations Committees are continuing. The stated goal of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is to have something ready for floor votes by next week. E&E News reporting that congressional Democrats are weighing options for moving ahead with President Biden's proposed $33 billion Ukraine aid request. The package is largely focused on military spending. However, $1.7 billion is slated to go toward international energy security concerns and about $500 million for the expanded domestic production of critical minerals. Also possibly attached, $10 billion in COVID-19 program spending. That also a supplemental request. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, speaking about all this on the Senate floor today.
The U.S. is rightly leading the supplier of military assistance to Ukraine's fighting forces. But to the administration's credit, they are also increasing coordinating a growing international response. While the preponderance of our support should focus on ensuring Ukraine has the military capability to defend itself in the months ahead, we should also contribute to the multinational economic and humanitarian support Kyiv needs. We must also make new investments in U.S. capabilities, addressing munition shortfalls and defense industrial bottlenecks to ensure that we can more rapidly produce critical weapon systems that would prove essential for Ukraine, vulnerable Eastern flank allies, or our own military in the months ahead. Obviously, there is broad bipartisan support for a robust aid package, but even a strong bipartisan vote will not mean much if we don't deliver on this promise soon. For this reason, we cannot allow this bill to be a vessel for extraneous matters. This isn't about battling climate change. This is about helping Ukraine defeat a military aggressor on the battleground. Urgent assistance for Ukraine's fight must move at the speed of relevance. Every day this aid spends tied down in unrelated business here in Washington is a day it's not helping Kyiv turn the tide. If the Senate is serious about helping Ukraine win, we need to show it by passing supplemental assistance. Clean, no strings attached, and soon.
The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor today. Ukraine also receiving pledges today for $6.5 billion more in humanitarian aid at an international donors conference in Warsaw, seeking to get Ukrainians urgent help while still planning for the country's post-war reconstruction. Mother Jones national security reporter Dan Spinelli noting in a tweet that the $33 billion request for additional aid from President Biden for Ukraine is more money than the U.S. has sent to all but four countries in total since 1946. Those four exceptions, Israel, Afghanistan, Egypt, and Iraq. A bill designed to increase U.S. competitiveness with China, especially in areas such as semiconductor chips, improving R&D, supply chains, now formally in a U.S. House and Senate conference where lawmakers will take the separate bills passed by the two chambers, reaching a single compromise version that both chambers can then pass again and send to President Biden, who might sign it into law. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer today on the Senate floor talking about the many votes Wednesday that made it possible to reach this point.
Last night, the Senate took another important step towards finalizing our bipartisan jobs and competition legislation that's been in the works for over a year. I thank all my colleagues last night for voting swiftly to process 26 motions to instruct the conference committee. Many of these were done by voice, and I appreciate everyone's hard work. We sat in our seats. No one at noon yesterday with 26 motions to instruct thought we'd finish by 10 p.m. or even at any point yesterday, but we have. That's good work. There's still a lot of work to do, of course, before we send the jobs bill to the president's desk. And I hope we'll see the same bipartisan good faith work in the conference that we saw last night on the floor of the Senate. We all know that no one is going to get everything they want, but if we keep working together, I'm confident we can come up with a strong final product. Our jobs and competition bill is just what the doctor ordered, to boost our economy, bring manufacturing jobs back home, and most of all, lower costs for American families.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor today. Reuters correspondent David Shepardson has been following this China competition bill and joins us now on the phone. Thanks for being on Washington Today. Many, many motions to instruct conferees in the Senate. Which ones from Wednesday night stood out to you?
Oh, there were a bunch. Certainly a lot of the motions that dealt with Iran, you know, Republicans are upset with the ongoing talks between the Biden administration and Iran about the nuclear deal that President Obama agreed to, but then President Trump withdrew from. And so, you know, given that Democrats and Majority Leader Schumer control the agenda on the Senate floor, this was one of the ways that they could use these votes to get across their opposition and to show that there are a number of Democratic senators that are also opposed to some aspects of a potential deal with Brand. However, ultimately to get to overturn any potential deal with Iran, opponents would need 60 votes. So that still is a long shot. So no, I think that there was a motion on climate that Senator Cato successfully got approved by a 49-47 vote that would seek to prevent President Biden from using climate change to declare a national emergency and exercise broader federal power. And then one other notable one, Senator Bernie Sanders, who has been on a long-running opposition to Amazon, and its chairman, Jeff Bezos, had a motion seeking to strike $10 billion for a second lunar lander project that would likely go to Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin space company if it ultimately were successful. So I think, there are a lot of interesting motions, but ultimately, this has just been another in a long, very, very long saga just to get to these formal talks. Because this process has now been going on for nearly a year, or really arguably more than a year when this idea first came up, since when the Senate in June of last year first passed its version.
What is in the underlying bill, and what are the major differences between what the Senate passed and the House passed?
That's a great question. So the issue or the thing that's gotten the most attention is identical in both bills, and that is $52 billion in taxpayer subsidies to dramatically expand U.S. semiconductor chip manufacturing and research. And, probably everybody has had some experience with the supply chain problems that are due to the lack of semiconductor chips. Most notable ones, or maybe the most public examples, are how automakers have struggled to keep plants open at times because they just can't get enough chips. And that's caused a lot of economic distress. And as a result, the auto market is still not in balance. Anybody who's gone to try to buy a car has seen it's hard to get one. They're very expensive. Dealers are often charging $5,000 or more over asking prices. So it's but it's not just cars. It's all sorts of products that use chips. And the second argument that the supporters make is most of the chips that the U.S. uses are assembled in Taiwan, which leaves the U.S. open to potential economic real problems if that flow of chips were ever disrupted, through a conflict with China or some other reason. So the main argument that the proponents have made is, for national security reasons, the U.S. needs to ramp up the number of chips it's making. Currently about 12% of the chips, which is down from about 40% 25 years ago. There are a lot of investments being announced. Intel is building one of these big fabricating facilities in Ohio, and many other investments have been announced in Arizona and New York and elsewhere. But it takes several years to build these big chip facilities, and so even if Congress approves the money, it will still take several years to award the money and get these factories built. But the other, so that part's pretty much in agreement. There are some critics, but by and large, has pretty bipartisan support. It's the other half of the bill, these China competitiveness issues. How does the U.S. boost technology research, education, and other programs? There are significant differences, and that would authorize between the two bills anywhere from $200 billion or so. But how does that ultimately get done? Through what entities? And then the House bill has a number of other provisions that deal with China, some on trade that are not in the Senate bill. So just getting all these negotiators from the House and Senate in a room and nailing down, you know, compromise language. And a lot of the issues, I think people agree, it's they're not that far apart, but there are extraneous issues that the House wants to include that the Senate doesn't agree to. And then the other big wild card is, you know, will the final bill include tax provisions, you know, tax incentives for semiconductor research and other issues. And the issue there is if Congress does decide to open this up to tax changes, would it also mean that other tax provisions might get in there? Because, you know, the year is running short, and it's not clear how many more major pieces of legislation will be passed this year. And so maybe this is one of the last big trains to leave the station.
David Shepardson is with Reuters. One other question. President Biden said earlier this week when he was visiting the weapons facility in Troy, Alabama, about talking about this bill, he said it's a national security issue. This is one of the reasons why the Chinese Communist Party is lobbying folks to oppose this bill. There are accusations that the China is trying to influence what's happening.
Well, that has been out there, you know, that idea. And certainly China is keeping a close eye on this bill. You know, and there are certainly a lot of big American companies that are in, you know, that are operating in China, too. It's hard to get a really clear sense because, you know, the Chinese efforts are behind the scenes. You know, they're not although I guess, to be fair, the Chinese foreign ministry has at times criticized portions of the bill. But no, I think there are some provisions about China and about who might get funding and about that not only raise concerns among the Chinese government, but about U.S. companies that do business in China, because there is concern among some lawmakers that if the U.S. government, the taxpayers, fund all this research and development, as well as chip production, that the benefits don't flow to China, or that companies receiving incentives don't take that money and opt to either directly or indirectly expand production in China. So, no, I think, you know, this is a major priority of the administration. You know, they've spent, you know, this has dragged on for almost a year. And I do think, especially with what the State Department says and others, that despite what's going on with Russia, that China remains sort of the long-term sort of biggest geopolitical adversary to the United States, that, you know, it kind of explains why there's been a lot of effort on this bill, but also a lot of pushback by the Chamber of Commerce and other businesses to ensure that it doesn't unduly restrict American companies that are operating both here and in China.
David Shepardson, a correspondent with Reuters. You can follow his stories at Reuters.com and on Twitter at David Shepardson. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
And here is some of the Senate debate on a motion to instruct conferees to this bill that was talked about dealing with Iran. It was offered by Senator James Lankford, Republican from Oklahoma, and the opposition coming from Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, this from Wednesday.
Mr. President, we're about to go to conference on what we're affectionately just calling the China bill. But this bill does not address China's practice of purchasing and stockpiling sanctioned Iranian oil in the black market. The procurement spike by China is directly correlated with the spike in terrorist activities by Iran and its proxies in the Middle East. Iran is laundering these petroleum products and illicitly transferring the oil at sea to Iranian tankers and foreign flag vessels. 3/4 of this oil is ultimately exported to China, which purchased 310 million barrels of oil from Iran last year. All this is happening while Iran is actually negotiating directly with Iran on our behalf in Vienna. This particular motion to instruct goes straight at this illicit activity from Iran that's facilitating the terror activities and also addresses the designation that Iran is asking if they're going to negotiate with the Biden administration on the Iran nuclear deal. Iran is specifically asking that they get a lift of the foreign terrorist organization on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. That is the group that was attacking our troops in Iraq and facilitating their death. We need to address this and take it off the table so that Iran does not get by with this and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps does not. I urge a yes motion on my motion to instruct.
Mr. President.
The senator from Connecticut.
Mr. President, I would urge opposition to this motion. This motion asks the Senate to endorse President Trump's Iran policy, a policy that, if you didn't notice, was a complete, total failure. The motion calls for a provision in the underlying bill to prohibit a return to the JCPOA and to keep Trump's maximum pressure campaign intact until a mythical comprehensive agreement is achieved with Iran, inclusive of all of their malevolent behavior. This policy, it just hasn't worked. And to apply it prospectively would be ruinous. Friends, Iran is weeks away from having enough nuclear material for a weapon. To deny this administration the ability to enter into a nuclear agreement isn't just folly, it's downright dangerous. I wish a comprehensive agreement with Iran was possible, but 4 years of failure by President Trump was proof that for the time being, it is not. We should not endorse 4 more years of this failed Iran policy, and I'd urge opposition.
Senator Chris Murphy, before that, Senator James Lankford. Lankford's motion to instruct conferees from Wednesday, one of 24 motions to instruct conferees to the competition bill. And this motion passed 62-33. The bill is now moving to a U.S. House Senate conference to work out a final version that can pass both the House and Senate in a final form and be signed into law. On Wall Street today, the Dow fell 1,063 points, NASDAQ down 647, S&P down 153. Dow and NASDAQ suffering their worst single-day losses since 2020, the S&P its second-worst day of the year, that according to CNBC. And this from CNN, about 14.9 million people around the world died as a direct or indirect result of COVID-19, between January 1st, 2020 and December 31st, 2021, according to new estimates from the World Health Organization, it's nearly three times more deaths than were officially reported. This as the U.S. is quickly closing in on 1 million deaths from COVID-19. White House announcing today that the Deputy Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, will become the press secretary when the current press secretary, Jen Psaki, steps down May 13th to take a job in cable news. Karine Jean-Pierre appeared at the White House briefing today and was asked to reflect on the fact that she'll be the first black woman to hold this position.
Wow, I am still processing it because, as Jen said at the top, this is a historic moment and it's not lost on me. I understand how important it is for so many people out there, so many different communities that I stand on their shoulders, and I have been throughout my career. And so it is an honor and a privilege to be behind this podium in about a week or so when Jen is ready. And that is something that I will honor and do my best to represent this president and this first lady the best that I can, but also the American people. And so it is, it's a very emotional day. That's probably the best way that I can explain that. A very emotional day. I just appreciate this time and this moment. And I hope that I make people proud.
I mean, there's a lot of folks who question when this day would happen. I mean, what is your message to those? And like, what is the message to young girls, to
And young boys, communities? Too. Young girls and young boys. Let's not, I think this is important for them to see this as well. I used to teach college students. I had the pleasure of doing that for about 6-7 years. And they would ask me, a similar question, like, how did you get to where you got to? And I would say to them, and it took me a little bit of time to figure this part out that I'm about to share with you, which is follow your passion, follow what you believe in, and just, keep that focus, because that matters. I think if you are passionate about what you want to be or where you want to go, and you work very hard to that goal, it will happen. And yes, you'll be knocked down and you'll have some tough times and it won't be easy all the time, but the rewards are pretty amazing, especially if you stay true to yourself. And so that's what I would tell them. And I see them from time to time, and they always mention those words that I just shared with all of you. And so that's what I would say. And, you know, there are people who support them, people who will lift them up when they're down. And so I think that's really important to know. You know, I think so many of them as well, they are standing on shoulders on folks who came before them and are creating these opportunities that I currently have. And we'll, you know, take that on the best as I can.
Deputy White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, the incoming press secretary, at today's White House briefing. White House also announcing the return of Anita Dunn as a senior advisor and assistant to the president, Dunn rejoining the White House staff from her communications and political consulting firm. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A coalition of progressive and reproductive rights groups are planning protests after the leaked Supreme Court draft opinion this week that, if it becomes the final majority opinion in a case out of Mississippi, would overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion nationwide. Those protests set for May 14th across the country, with major marches in New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. They're calling it Bans Off Our Bodies. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today referencing the leaked Supreme Court draft opinion as she appeared at the opening of the Vital Voices Global Headquarters for Women's Leadership in Washington.
And as the mayor so rightly said, this equality corridor is both a reminder of how far we have come and a rebuke to all who would try to turn the clock back on the progress in advancing human rights and civil rights, human dignity and human freedom, and particularly women's equality. Now, I know this is a quite ironic week for us to be opening the headquarters, but in a way, it's probably appropriate because no advance is ever permanent. There are always forces at work to turn the clock back, particularly on women. And we know there still is a double standard about what is or is not expected and appropriate for how women make the choices in our own lives. So as we open this headquarters, I want us not only to think of it as a building, and it is a beautiful building. Elise Nelson, who has done this amazing job leading the organization, and all those who work with her, have truly produced a fabulous place for women to come and convene, to talk, to argue, to reach consensus, and then to go out and continue to be change makers.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at the grand opening of the Vital Voices Global Headquarters for Women's Leadership in Washington, D.C. It's being touted as the world's first global embassy for women. The group Vital Voices was founded by Hillary Clinton and the late Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in 1997 when Hillary Clinton was First Lady of the United States. White House Economic Advisor Jared Bernstein making the argument today that overturning Roe v. Wade, the legalized abortion, would harm women not just when it comes to their constitutional liberties, but economically. He was on CNN.
Some of our most rigorous and high-quality economic research, and by that I mean research that really establishes causation, asks about this very question. And it finds that when you deny access to reproductive rights in general, but abortion rights in particular to women, they have persistently worse economic outcomes. Financially, it's like losing a job. It's like being evicted. It's like losing health insurance. It's like going to the hospital in terms of its impact on their finances. If you look at occupation, earnings, education, maternal health, all of those indicators are significantly damaged when we restrict access to abortion. Again, some of our highest quality research consistently finds it, and it finds that these effects are most pernicious for women of color and for younger women. So this is it's a justice issue, it's a liberty issue, it's a women's rights issue, of course, health issue first and foremost, personal decision. But it is also, at its core here, an economic issue, particularly for younger women and women of color.
Jared Bernstein is a member of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, part of his interview today on CNN. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, saying the Senate will have a procedural vote next Wednesday related to a Democratic bill that would codify federal abortion protections. The title of the bill is the Women's Health Protection Act. Senator Schumer speaking on the floor today.
Today, I am announcing that next week, the U.S. Senate is going to vote on legislation to codify a woman's right to seek an abortion into federal law. Let me repeat that. I am announcing that next week, the U.S. Senate is going to vote on legislation to codify a woman's right to seek an abortion into federal law. I intend to file cloture on this vital legislation on Monday, which was set up a vote for Wednesday. All week, we've been seeing Republicans try to duck, dodge, and dip from their responsibility for bringing Roe to the brink of total repeal. That's what they've been trying to do for decades. Next week, the American people will see crystal clear that when given the chance to right this wrong, the Republican Party will either side with the extremists who want to ban abortion without exceptions, or side with women, and with families, and with the vast majority of Americans.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor. Next week's procedural motion will need 60 votes to move the bill forward. The Senate held a similar vote on a similar version of the bill back in February. It failed 46-48, with Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, joining all Republicans in voting no. From ABC News, a new imposing 8-foot-high fence was erected overnight at the Supreme Court in the wake of protests over a bombshell draft opinion on abortion. Abortion rights activists and some anti-abortion protesters have rallied at the Supreme Court each day since Politico reported the draft document on Monday. Protesters on both sides of the issue gathered again in front of the building around noon on Thursday. Neither the Supreme Court nor Capitol Police have said anything publicly about possible threats to the court or the justices. That from ABC News. Senator John Cornyn, Republican from Texas, speaking on the Senate floor today about the safety and security of the court and the justices.
We need to take steps to improve the protection of the justices and their family against potential violence. And it can't wait until something bad happens. Some political activists have already announced their intentions to go to the private homes of the justices. This is an appalling violation of their personal privacy and puts them and their families at risk. We currently have two justices with school-aged children. Once Judge Jackson joins the court, when Justice Breyer steps down, that'll be three. The Chief Justice has asked Congress to take appropriate action to increase protection for the physical safety of the justices and their families. And we need to act, and act with urgency. Senator Coons, our friend from Delaware, a Democrat, and I are introducing a bill, a bipartisan bill, obviously, called the Supreme Court Police Parity Act to strengthen security protection for the justices and their families. This will ensure they receive, the justices receive the same protection and resources that Article I and Article II officers and their families enjoy. For our present purposes, that means they will be given the same authority that the Capitol Police already have here on Capitol Hill. I appreciate our friend Senator Coons working with me on this important legislation, and I hope the entire Senate will vote on it soon. As far as the larger debate about the draft document that was released, it's important to remember we don't actually know what the Supreme Court is going to decide until it actually does decide. The justices are still working through the deliberative process, and our respect for the independence of the court requires that we let it proceed without interference. While tensions and emotions may be high, It's important to note that overruling earlier Supreme Court decisions is nothing new.
Senator John Cornyn on the Senate floor today. The ABC News article continues. The justices are scheduled to next meet in person for a private conference on May 12th. And a final decision in the abortion case, which centers on a Mississippi law banning the procedure after 15 weeks of pregnancy, is expected by the end of June or early July. Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing steps today that he says will help secure environmental justice for all Americans, including a new office in the Justice Department to prioritize environmental justice and climate issues. Attorney General holding a news conference today at the department in Washington.
Today, I am announcing three actions that the department is taking to advance environmental justice. First, consistent with the president's executive order on tackling the climate crisis at home and abroad, we are issuing a comprehensive environmental justice enforcement strategy. Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta will discuss that strategy in just a moment. Second, I'm pleased to announce that we are launching the Justice Department's first ever Office of Environmental Justice to oversee and help guide the Justice Department's wide-ranging environmental justice efforts. Like all parts of government, it will get its own acronym, OEJ. And third, the Justice Department is issuing an interim final rule that will restore the use of an important law enforcement tool, supplemental environmental projects, subject to new guidelines and limitations that I will also be issuing today. Administrator Regan and I know that the communities most impacted by environmental harm are not isolated in any one part of our country. Environmental crime and injustice touch communities in all our cities, towns, rural areas, and on tribal lands. Although violations of our environmental laws can happen anywhere, communities of color, indigenous communities, and low-income communities often bear the brunt of the harm caused by environmental crime, pollution, and climate change. They include communities, fence-line communities, where exposure to toxic air pollutants have caused scores of cancer-related deaths. They include communities where students have been exposed to harmful emissions from boilers in their public schools. They include communities where infectious diseases have spread because of inadequate wastewater management. And for far too long, these communities have faced barriers to accessing the justice they deserve.
Attorney General Merrick Garland at the Justice Department, joined by the EPA Administrator and the Associate Attorney General. And this new Office of Environmental Justice does fulfill a campaign promise from President Joe Biden. The Attorney General announcing that the acting director will be Cynthia Ferguson, an attorney in the department's Environment and Natural Resources Division. From Associated Press, the Biden administration has begun expelling Cubans and Nicaraguans to Mexico under pandemic-related powers to deny migrants a chance to seek asylum, expanding use of a rule even as it publicly says it has been trying to unwind it, officials said Wednesday. They're carried out under Title 42 authority, which was named for a public health law and used to expel migrants on the grounds of preventing the spread of COVID-19. Title 42 was due to expire May 23rd. Biden administration has been saying that it expects a dramatic increase in asylum seekers along the U.S.-Mexico border when Title 42 goes away, and it's taking steps to prepare for it. Today, we heard from the Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary of Administration for Children and Families, January Contreras. She was before a Senate committee talking about how to process unaccompanied minors and family units.
Unaccompanied children have generally not been subject to Title 42 since November of 2020. However, we are planning and preparing for any potential increase in referrals that might result from the termination of Title 42 for adults and family units. We have developed contingency plans that allow us to build capacity as needed and deploy additional case management supports should referrals significantly increase. Today, we have cooperative agreements for 13,613 beds in our standard network for children. This is the highest number of standard beds in the history of the Unaccompanied Children Program. We have and continue to build greater capacity for more standard beds for kids, including adding to existing grants and funding new grants, authorizing hazard and incentive pay to retain and recruit staff, and working closely with CDC on COVID mitigation measures to keep children and staff safe. In addition to our standard beds, ORR has also utilized influx care facilities and emergency intake sites. Out of the 14 emergency intake sites that were utilized last year, only two remain active. Pecos EIS and the ORR EIS at Fort Bliss. Although emergency intake sites are temporary, they do allow us to quickly add beds for children when we need them.
January Contreras, Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary of Administration for Children and Families, testifying before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee today. At the White House, on the South Lawn, a Cinco de Mayo celebration. 160th anniversary of Mexico's military victory over a larger French army in the 1862 Battle of Puebla. President Joe Biden, alongside the First Lady Jill Biden, and the wife of the Mexican president, Beatriz Gutierrez Weller de López Obrador. Here's President Biden.
As I said, it's important. As I said in my State of the Union address, we can secure our borders and keep lit the torch of liberty. On my first day in office, I sent an immigration bill to Congress that would provide a pathway to citizenship for immigrants contributing to our economy. That's we are an immigrant nation. I mean, we say that, but people act like they don't believe it. We are an immigrant nation, and that is our strength. That is our strength. But if Congress won't act on broader reform, let's pass the bills that have bipartisan support for Dreamers and those temporary protected status farm workers, essential workers. Not only the right thing to do, but it's economically the smart thing to do as well. And most of all, we're going to continue to fight for the rights and opportunities and dignity of Mexican Americans and all Latinos in America. I might point out, and Jill and I talk about this, if we don't get smart in this country and the other team doesn't understand what's going on, you know, 25 out of every 100 children in grades kindergarten through senior in high school speak Spanish. 25 out of every 100. It's overwhelming the interest not only of those kids, but of all Americans that we invest in the community. And we'll conquer and honor and lift up all those folks who, in fact, have gotten in the way. You know, Mexican-American culture is a great contribution to America. And soon we'll also see the broader Latino community culture celebrated through the creation of the newest Smithsonian Museum, the National Museum of American Latino. It's a big deal. And I look forward to seeing it take its rightful place here in Washington.
President Joe Biden at the White House Cinco de Mayo celebration today. C-SPAN 2's Book TV interviewed the author of El Cinco de Mayo, An American Tradition, UCLA Professor David Hayes Bautista. He explains that Cinco de Mayo is celebrated more in the U.S. than in Mexico because it all started in the 1860s during the U.S. Civil War, when Mexicans living in California took inspiration from an underdog Mexican army beating a stronger French army to rally for the Union in the Civil War and freedom and equality and anti-slavery against the Confederacy, which France supported. Here's part of our interview.
I was in Guadalajara. This was in the late 70s, early 80s. And I thought, and it just happened to be on a Cinco de Mayo, which was unusual because normally I'd go in the summer. But for some reason, I was there in May before summer. I thought, I'm going to see the biggest, best Cinco de Mayo ever. I go running down to the main plaza right in front of the cathedral, got a really good seat. And I waited. And I waited. And I waited. And nothing. And I went back and I said to my cousin, well, where was your Cinco de Mayo? What Cinco de Mayo? Don't you have a parade? No, you don't. And that's when I began to discover just really how differently Cinco de Mayo is commemorated in the two countries. Now that I understand it's part of the Civil War, which impacted Latinos tremendously here, if the Confederacy had won, basically there was no future for Latinos in the American West, all the parts that would have been slave territory. They bet the ranch. It looked very shaky, but the Cinco de Mayo became to Latinos, kind of the way the Alamo is for Anglo-Texans, kind of, we'll always remember this. Let us never forget. And it so impacted the Latino community that 152 years later, we still continue to celebrate, although we have forgotten why.
It has evolved into more of a, just a festival, right?
Some people think of it as simply like St. Patrick's Day or something, or just another quote-unquote ethnic festival. But what I discovered as I was doing the research to write this book is about constitutional issues. Freedom versus slavery, white supremacy versus racial equality, democracy, participatory forms of government versus elitist. And of course, always the issue of what about the rights for married women, women's rights. And these are in many ways very Latin American constitutional values that were here present in California because this had been part of Mexico and Latin America, and these values then became part of the United States.
UCLA professor David Hayes Bautista, the author of El Cinco de Mayo, an American Tradition, on C-SPAN 2's Book TV, an interview recorded in 2014. And you can find it in full at our website, cspan.org/booktv. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word to get more of Washington's top stories sent to you each day. Go to c-span.org/connect to subscribe. Have a good night.